Well, I can empathize with Dave's story about his daughter, Christina. When I was in Canada, I got a full ride from the National Research Council, took care of all my tuition, books, expenses, even gave a stipend to my professor to fund my research. But the wonderful thing about Canada is that the parents are allowed to take a deduction as long as their child is still a full-time student. So here I was finishing up my PhD, and my dad called me and says, "Can't you take some extra time to get your doctorate?" So I mean, just take an extra few months, I can claim you this year.
Did you?
No, I didn't. I had an offer at Caltech, and I was anxious to get there, so I went ahead and took care of that. We're going to jump into, well, we already have jumped into Proverbs 30, but several of you reminded me that I didn't actually fulfill my promise to talk about this paper on the origin of life. So, and I forgot to bring the paper with me, but if you want to check it out, I got several tweets on my Twitter page that refer to this paper. But it was all over the internet about the fact that these scientists discovered that they could use hydrogen cyanide to make all three classes of the building block molecules of life. And what they're referring to were the amino acids that are the building blocks of the proteins, the nucleosides that are the building blocks of DNA and RNA, and then the lipid molecules, which are the building blocks of the membranes. And you need all three to have the simplest possible organism. And so they found that they could take this hydrogen cyanide and actually make an amino acid, they can make a nucleoside, and they can make a lipid. And therefore they said, we have solved the origin of life problem. Yeah. Well, if you actually read the paper, what you discovered, well, first of all, hydrogen cyanide sounds like something complex. It's simply a hydrogen atom attached to a carbon atom attached to a nitrogen atom. So it's only got three atoms. It's HCN. So it's one of the simplest molecules. And, you know, it contains nitrogen, hydrogen, and carbon. And, you know, life molecules are made up of hydrogen, carbon, and nitrogen. But as you read the paper, what you discovered is it was a completely different chemical pathway to start with HCN and wind up with an amino acid as it was to start with HCN and make up a nucleoside, or start with HCN and make up one of these molecules that is a subset of the membrane. Moreover, each pathway was chemically complex, which took a well-funded lab with very expert biochemists to make the pathway work. You know, as I read the paper, I realized none of these pathways are relevant to the chemical conditions that existed on the surface of the Earth 3.8 billion years ago. And by the way, where are the sugars? If you don't have sugars, you can't put together nucleosides to make the RNA and the DNA. And that's a fundamental problem for all naturalistic origin of life models, is that we do not see any naturalistic source of the 5 and 6 carbon sugars that are fundamental to life. The best they have found are 3 carbon glycoaldehydes, and there they find them at very low abundance levels. But yeah, no matter where we look, outside of organisms or the decay products of organisms, no sugars. You got no sugars, you can't link together the nucleosides to make the amino acids. The other thing is that we actually do find these molecules that are talking about in nature, but they're of the simplest kind. And so, for example, they're able to manufacture glycine, but if you look at glycine, it's only got 10 atoms in it. It's the simplest of the amino acids. And they have found 6 of the biologically bioactive amino acids in meteorites. Although there's some research that indicates that the only reason why you find 6 is that when the meteorite passes through the Earth's atmosphere and collides with the Earth, the heat generated from the collision with the Earth is actually responsible for making the amino acids. In terms of what we actually find out there in outer space, they have found glycine, the simplest of the amino acids, in a comet. However, if we look at these interstellar clouds, which are the richest source of these carbonaceous molecules, they found about 125 of them so far. No glycine, no nucleosides. So, by the way, they did announce some 15 years ago that they had discovered glycine in interstellar cloud. But about 5 years ago, a paper was published in the Astrophysical Journal, which basically said, oops, we misidentified the spectral lines. It's not glycine after all. So, and by the way, I'm on record as saying, don't be surprised if they do discover a few of these simple amino acids and maybe even some of the nucleosides at parts per billion. The spectrometers they're using are sensitive down to about one part per 100 million. But once we get down to parts per billion, I expect they're going to find them. But of course, if you got them at abundance levels of parts per billion, that's not going to be of any help for any kind of naturalistic origin of life model. So again, this paper is published is very much akin to what Fuzz Rana has written in the book over there, Creating Life in the Lab, is that we've made amazing progress at actually duplicating some of the chemical pathways that we know are critical for the origin of life. But in spite of the fact that we're using the greatest technology, funding from one of the richest men on the planet, namely Craig Venter, you know, he has this amazing lab where he's poured in his hundreds of millions of dollars, hired the best biochemists, and yes, they've been able to actually manufacture or re-engineer some of these bacteria to do things. By the way, one of the things I'm excited about, he claims that his team of biochemists soon might be able to re-engineer bacterium so that as it metabolizes, it actually makes a petroleum. And so, hey, you know, when we run out of petroleum, we can use these bacteria to do it. So, but it's not making life from scratch. It's simply engineering, re-engineering life that already exists, and it's at the bacterial level. And as Fuzz points out in his book, this is dramatic evidence that it takes a god to explain the origin of life, because clearly it takes someone more brilliant and better funded than Craig and his lab and all of his biochemists. So it needs someone who's more intelligent and better funded than those individuals. But hey, literally just 2 days ago, this paper got published I want to talk to you about. It was published in Science, and the paper is titled Ab Initio Calculation of the Neutron Proton Mass Difference. Yeah, you've read that, right? Yeah, it's what my wife Kathy keeps pointing out. It says they need to train these scientists how to title their papers. I mean, so, but you read the abstract and you kind of figure what it's all about. And actually what's exciting about this is they've uncovered a pathway to discover more fine-tuning design of the fundamental physics of the universe. And in particular, they're looking at the design of the ratio of the proton mass to the neutron mass. Now, we've already had some indication that there's incredible fine-tuning there. What's exciting about this paper says we have a means by which we can actually calculate the degree of fine-tuning, and it's going to be orders of magnitude more spectacular than what we've already been able to establish. And it's basically a means by which they look at the character of the quarks that make up the protons and the neutrons. Now, I won't go into the technical details. Again, you can check my Twitter page where I try to give you those and I give you the links to the papers. But what they're really examining is the balance in the electromagnetic and the mass, what they call the mass isospin breaking effects of the, anyway, I won't go into the details. And by the way, they did not calculate the fine tuning, but they said this is a new pathway to calculate fine tuning, but reading the paper, it's going to be quite a bit more spectacular than we already know. Now, if you got my book over there called The Creator and the Cosmos, I actually talk about this, what we knew about it before we were able to explore these isospin effects of the quarks. Namely, that when you look at the neutron, it's 0.138% more massive than the proton. And to kind of figure that out, neutrons by themselves decay. They decay in 10 minutes and 11 seconds. So if you have a bachelor neutron outside the nucleus, you leave it alone for about 10 minutes, it will decay, and it decays into a proton, an electron, and a neutrino. So that explains why it's a little bit more massive. Basically, what a neutron is, it's a combination of a proton, a neutrino, and electron. A little bit of energy is thrown in there as well. So it comes in at 0.138% more massive. But because it's slightly more massive than the proton, it takes a little more energy for the universe to make neutrons than it does to make protons. And so out of the Big Bang creation event, there's a preference for the universe to make protons over neutrons. And the ratio we see in the universe today is that there's 7 protons for every neutron. That comes as a shock because all around us there's a rough balance between protons and neutrons. In fact, more neutrons than there are protons. So if you look at your physical body or everything in this room, there's actually more neutrons than there are protons. But if you look at the universe as a whole, there's literally 7 protons for every neutron. Now, if you were to make the neutron mass a little bit less than 0.138% more massive than the proton, say make it 0.1% more massive, what would happen is the universe would make so many neutrons compared to protons that quickly everything would collapse into black holes and neutron stars. And there we have densities that exceed 2 billion tons per level teaspoonful, which means you have a universe with no molecules, not even any atoms, not even any protons or electrons. So yeah, you don't want the universe making a higher ratio of neutrons compared to protons. You say, well, what happens when you go the other way around, where you have the neutron mass a little bit more than 0.13% greater than the proton mass? Well, now you make so few neutrons that you're going to have a universe with no elements heavier than iron. Now, for example, you will die if you don't have copper in your body. Copper is one of those elements that's heavier than iron. In fact, there's a good half dozen elements in your body, things like tin and iodine, copper, that are heavier, and without those, you would literally die. Moreover, you would have a planet with no uranium and thorium. If you got no uranium and thorium, you will not have the energy to transform the planet from a water world into a world where you got oceans and continents coexisting on the surface. So from that perspective alone, we know that it's crucial to fine-tune the ratio of the neutron mass compared to the proton mass. We also know if we were to change that ratio by as little as 0.1%, then we have a universe that will not be able to sustain life. But this paper is saying we think the fine-tuning is even more spectacular than that. And the reason this paper is getting such excitement, this is one of the more dramatic fine-tuning design evidences we have in the physics of the universe. But in reading the paper, it's also exploring the proton decay. Neutrons decay, but protons decay as well. Now, in the case of the neutron, the decay time is 10 minutes, 11 seconds. Can anybody guess what the decay time of the proton is?
Several billion years.
Several billion years. It's actually a little bit more than several billion years. The half-life decay time for the proton is 400 million trillion years. Well, that's actually a good thing, because if protons were decaying more rapidly than that, that would be a problem for your bodies. I mean, after all, our bodies are made up of protons and neutrons, and the neutrons are stable if they're attached to the proton in the nucleus, so they don't decay in 10 minutes, 11 seconds when they're inside the nucleus. So don't worry about your neutrons decaying. It's not going to happen. You don't have to worry about your protons decaying either, because the half-life for proton decay is literally 400 million trillion years. But physicists have asked the question, by the way, how do we know that? Well, one reason we know that is that if protons did not decay, then in the Big Bang creation event, you would have equal numbers of nucleons and antinucleons. By the way, nucleon is a term for proton and neutron. Or baryon, that's another term that includes both protons and neutrons. But when God created the universe, there were no protons, there were no neutrons. Instead, what you have is this energy, and what it does is you wind up having all these protons and neutrons, but you also have antiprotons and antineutrons. Now, in the universe in which we live, when the universe was very young, there was about 100 billion ordinary nucleons for every, 100 billion and one particles for every 100 billion antiparticles. Now, what happens when a particle and an antiparticle get together? They annihilate one another, and all you get is energy. Okay, so here's the problem. If protons were to decay at a slower rate than a half-life of 400 billion trillion trillion years, the balance between protons, or pardon me, particles and antiparticles at that mass level would be so close to one another that when they annihilated one another, there wouldn't be enough protons and neutrons left over to make the galaxies, the stars, and the planets we need so that we can have life. Okay, so when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for the fact that there was this special half-life time for the proton, because otherwise we wouldn't even have a planet to live on. Yes?
Wouldn't a little longer inflation have solved that problem?
It's
there was more particles created, so there would be enough to make galaxies.
Well, what the inflation does is spread the mass apart, because, yeah, even with that half-life for the proton, if there's no inflation, then the galaxies are so close together that by the time the universe is old enough for life to be possible, you've got stars literally jammed too close together to one another. You're not going to have stable planet orbits. You're going to be irradiated. So it's important inflation spread things apart. So... but yeah, so if you actually have the proton decaying more rapidly than a half-life of 400 million trillion trillion years, you now wind up with a universe that's going to have too many protons and neutrons. So there's going to be way too many galaxies and stars and planets in the universe. And with all those stars and planets and galaxies in the universe, you're, even with inflation, you're going to have those galaxies jammed so tightly together that you're not going to have stable spiral arms, you're not going to have stable orbits of planets, and you're going to be irradiated. So yeah, it has to be fine-tuned. And by the way, it's got to be fine-tuned for another reason. We human beings live a long time. You know, 50, 60, 70, 100. We had a gentleman in this class who was 101 years old. We live a long time. By the way, he drove himself to class. So, a remarkable individual. He was with us for quite some time.
What was his name?
Sorry, it's not. I can't pick it up the top of my tongue, but he was actually here when you were here in the class. He passed away just a few months ago because he wound up getting a flu-type condition and was not able to recover from it. So,
but.
Don, yeah, that's right. But here's the problem. Take a 200-pound man or 200-pound woman, doesn't make any difference. They'll have about 10 to the 29 protons and neutrons in their body. So that's 10 to the 29 protons and neutrons, but the decay life of a proton is 4 times 10 to the 32 years. What does that mean? That means there's a decent possibility, if you live 100 years and you weigh 200 pounds, that you could have a proton decay in your body. You say, well, what happens when a proton decays in your body? A big release of energy. Now, if one proton decays in your body throughout your life, you'll probably survive the event. But if several protons decay, that's not a good thing. And by the way, I've actually used that as an argument against what you see in the Akkadian and Sumerian ancient literature, where they claim that their kings lived more than 10,000 years each. Well, if they were living that long, they'd be experiencing a few more proton decays than the rest of us, and that would be a problem for them. So what about people living 800 or 900 years? I think you're okay. You're only going to live 800 or 900 years. That's about the limit for human beings simply based on proton decay. So, but if, hey, if you're only going to live to be 120, I wouldn't worry about the proton decays in your body. Yes?
I don't know if I understand this. Do the protons decay because of antiprotons? Because if they are
400 million billion years, then they're older than the, I mean, that they're going to last longer than the universe. It's only 13.7 billion. So how can they decay if they last that long unless you're saying those answers?
Okay, thanks for clarifying that.
Okay.
When protons decay, they decay into mesons. So they do not decay into antiprotons. They decay into mesons. And, you know, when the universe was very young, it had almost an equivalent amount of protons and antiprotons. They annihilated one another when the universe was less than a billionth of a second old. And so what survives is the excess of protons and neutrons compared to antiprotons and antineutrons. And with a decay time for the proton of 4 times 10 to the 32 years, you wind up with about 100 billion and one real particles for every 100 billion antiparticles. So isn't that interesting that the universe actually had 100 billion times more mass, at the very beginning of the universe than it does today? Literally only 1/100 billionth of the mass of the universe survived that annihilation event. But my whole point is, for life to be possible, you don't want the annihilation to be any greater or any lesser. Otherwise, you're going to wind up with galaxies, stars, and planets that are either not extensive enough or so extensive it's going to cause a problem. Yes?
Since the half-life of a proton is greater than the entire life of the universe to date, I think this is probably a simplistic viewpoint. Therefore, why should you have any proton decay?
That's what I said.
But you're saying that the half-life means, let's say you have 100 protons. 50 of them are going to disappear in that half-life.
Right.
And then 25 will disappear in another one of those half-lives.
Yeah, it's quantum mechanics.
So you may have some disappear after a few million years, for example.
Right.
They don't all last that half-life.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just like in quantum mechanics. It's a probability distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, that you're going to have, say, somewhere on the order of half, it's not exactly half, disappear by the time the universe is 4 times 10 to the 32 years old. But a very tiny number of those protons and neutrons will disappear before then. And it's certain that protons have decayed into mesons over the course of the 14 billion year history of the universe. So yeah, the universe has lost some of its protons, but because of the long half-life, it's only lost an extremely tiny percentage, which is why it's necessary in terms of worrying about proton decay in your physical body. Well, how many protons do you have? Well, if you got 10 to the 29 protons and you live 100 years, then there is a possibility, not a large one, but there's a possibility you might suffer a proton decay in your lifetime.
What would cause that premature decay?
That premature decay is just simply the fact that you're dealing with quantum entities. And so you basically get what's called a bell curve for the decay. Some of those protons are going to last a whole lot longer than 10 to the 32 years. Some are going to last 10 to the 36 years. Some are only going to last 10 to the 10 years. And the universe is 14 billion years old, which means some of those protons in the universe have actually decayed into mesons. But not enough that it actually has an impact on terminating your life. Other causes, in other words, when you go to the doctor, he's not going to say, well, you know, you had suffered a proton decay. A single proton decay probably is not going to have much impact on you, but if you have a bunch of them decaying, yeah, now you're in trouble. So, and again, if you're going to live to be 10,000 years old, proton decays are significant. If you're only live to be 100, no need to worry about it. And hey, if you're going to live to be 1,000, there's a chance you could live to 1,000 of proton decays doing much damage. But it's another reason why the proton decay must be fine-tuned. It must be fine-tuned if you want to have creatures on the surface of the Earth that live as long as we human beings live and are as big as we are. Now, if you're tiny, don't worry about it. If you're an ant, you don't have very many protons compared to human beings, so you can solve the problem that way. But it actually gives us some appreciation. why God made us human beings with the body mass that we have, with the potential longevity we have. It's actually very close to the limit of what proton decay will permit. So what it means is God actually optimized our human bodies and our longevity based on the physics of the universe. Yes?
Is the half-life of the proton free and bound different? Like the neutrons, things like free neutrons and bound neutrons are different?
Well, it's different with protons. It doesn't matter where the protons are, they're going to decay with the same half-life. So whether they're in the nucleus or not, it doesn't make any difference. But because the neutron has such a short half-life, yeah, being bound in the nucleus does make a big difference. A strong nuclear force has an impact there. But with a half-life as long as 4 times 10 to the 32 years, that's not going to help you. Now, this also has a theological implication. For people who believe that our eternal destiny is going to be in this universe, well, once 10 to the 32 years go by, the universe, the protons will start disappearing at a great rate. So our eternal destiny, based on proton decay alone, cannot reside within this universe. It's got to be someplace beyond the universe. Now, we may laugh at this, but there are actually evangelical Christian theologians who hold the view that the new creation is a restored earth in a restored universe, with the same physics we have now, but we simply give bodies that can live forever within this universe. Well, again, proton decay tells us that theology needs some adjustment, but I also would argue from the Bible itself, we can appreciate that the new creation is a different realm with different physics, different dimensions. If you want to read more about that, you can check out my book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. I'm going to skip some more scientific discoveries because I want to jump into our text in Proverbs chapter 30. And for those of you who have been with us the last couple of weeks, what you see in Proverbs 30, actually about half the chapter is dealing with creation theology. It begins with who has gone up to heaven and come down, who has gathered up the wind in the hollow of his hands, who has wrapped up the waters in his cloak, who has established all the ends of the earth? What is the name and the name of the sun? Tell me if you know. Reads a lot like what you see in Job 38 and 39, where God gathers Job and his friends and asks them a lot of questions. Hey, you think you're so smart? Answer me this, answer me this, answer me this. This has the same tone as that, basically saying, hey, you think you're so smart? You think you understand everything? Well, what do you know about this and that? But then it goes on in the text and basically talks about some of the great mysteries of nature. As we mentioned last week, there's this interesting pattern where it breaks it into three things and four things. And I asked you the question last week, why does the text do that? Why does it mention three mysteries and then talks about a fourth? There are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. And we see that with two more examples. If you read on in the chapter, it also talks about these two sets of three things I don't understand, three things that are amazing and mysterious, and four that I do not understand. As we went through this last week, what we recognize is that each set of three plus one, it's distinguishing a mystery about the created realm, basically about animals. And then the fourth one is always in the context of human beings. It's basically saying, hey, there are mysteries with these higher animals you don't understand. But if you really want something that's challenging, look at what's going on with we human beings. Now, I've actually used this text in debates with theistic evolutionists, making the point, this text is telling us we human beings, compared to the highest animals, are still exceptional. We're distinct. This goes all the way back to Genesis 1, where it talks about God creating three separate categories of life. Life is purely physical, life is physical and soulish, and one and only species that's physical, soulish, and spiritual. And so here's a text that's making the point, and when we get to human beings, we're in an entirely different category than all the other higher animals. We did not evolve from these higher animals. We're a special creation distinct from the higher animals. Now, last week I talked about what's so amazing about the eagle. You know, it's a bird that's got features that no other animal has. An animal with eyes that see in six colors. By the way, most animals don't see in any colors at all, or they see in two colors. We humans are exceptional in that we see in three colors. So we see in three basic colors, which is why as you look around the room, we see all this color diversity. We can actually recognize these colors. And, you know, our eyes are actually capable not only of recognizing the three primary colors, but about 10,000 subcategories of colors. We can do that. But the eagle's got six colors, not three. And because the eagle sees in six primary colors, it can see variations of shading and coloration and texture our human eyes are not capable of seeing, which explains why it can spot a mouse from a couple of miles away. Because it can see things. That mouse thinks it's well camouflaged. We can't see it, but the eagle is able to see it. The other thing about the eagle's eye is that it's actually got a pair of binoculars it's basically got a telescope. Each of its eyes has a telescope embedded in it. And so the eye itself sees like our human eye does, but the very center of the eye has got a special telescope where it's able to magnify to a high degree, and that's another reason why it can see a mouse from a couple of miles away, whereas we can't. Yes?
Does it have about the same spectral response we have, or does it see the infrared that can be the heat signature of its prey as well?
I'm not knowledgeable on that. My guess is that its spectral response is very similar to ours. For example, if it was sensitive into the ultraviolet, that could cause damage for the eye, although it doesn't live as long as we do, so that may not be an issue. And I don't know if there's any evidence about eagles being able to hunt at night, which would be the advantage of being able to see in infrared. And we also talked about how the eagle has this amazing ability to fly for hours on end and expend very little energy. Basically because the eagle's mind, if you like, is able to figure out when to take off. So you notice that eagles stay in these little high areas, either a very high tree or a high stone structure or on top of some human structure that we built. They basically sit up really high where there's lots of air around them, and they wait for the right air conditions or the wind conditions. When the right conditions take place, then they take off. They're basically looking for drafts that will allow them to soar effortlessly for hours on end. And as they're soaring around over an open area, they're on the lookout for little creatures that think they're able to hide from the eagle, but they can't. And the other amazing thing about the eagle is that when it, say, it spots a rabbit or a mouse or a rat down there in the ground, here it is, you know, way up there in the sky, and it's able to change its wing formation, basically do a dive bomb. I mean, it's a heavy bird, so if it collapses its wings, it's going to fall to the ground really fast. But the incredible thing about eagles is just before they crash into the ground and kill themselves, they're able to, they got the wing structure that enables them to make a very quick halt in their descent before they hit the ground, but they're able to hit their prey with enough force that they kill it, but they don't get killed in the process. So, amazing creature. And so basically this text is saying, you don't understand this? And moreover, from an evolutionary perspective, how did the eagle get all these capabilities from some other kind of bird through a process of evolution? I mean, can you imagine, some kind of hawk or a jay or a kike, and it evolves and comes up with an eagle that has all these features? No other predatory bird has these features. It's unique to the eagle. By the way, there's limitations. Because of this, the eagle's got to limit its hunting to open areas because its wing structures are not able to maneuver in and out of trees or around jagged stone structures. It looks for the open areas, and which is why it's got to be able to see a couple of miles away, because after all, when you're in that big of an open area, the prey can see you too. But that's one reason why it wants to fly up high and why it wants to fly effortlessly. If it can just soar, there's no sound. And that's what the eagle looks for, the wind conditions where it can fly with no sound. And therefore the creatures scampering around the ground don't even know there's an eagle up there until the eagle decides to do a dive bomb, and there goes that little creature. Yes.
When he dies down, he's like silk. But when he comes down, does he plan that there's going to be enough of a current of up points to take him back up? Or how does he get that?
Well, his wing structure is such that, you know, as they come close to the ground, they're able to break their fall, and the eagle expends a lot of energy in breaking that fall. But hey, it's got a meal, so he's going to be fine. So, well, yeah, he can go back up if he wants to, but typically they just go straight down the ground. So even if they miss their prey, they'll land on the ground, and then they'll take off and get up on some high top of a tree, and they wait for the right wind conditions. But yeah, they're basically counting the fact that they're not going to miss. And typically they don't, yes.
How actually fast is that?
The speed?
Yeah.
They're not as fast. I think there's the Peregrine Falcon has got the highest dive speed. And, you know, it's basically free fall gravity. It's more than 100 miles an hour.
I think it's over 200.
Over 200 miles an hour? Yeah.
Why haven't we been able to copy that without airplanes?
Well, there's actually research being done, for example, on birds to build better helicopters. So people have been doing research on hummingbirds and birds. And the thing you notice about birds is that the width of their wings is a lot greater compared to the length than our airplanes are. Our airplanes tend to have long wings that are not that wide. Birds have wide wings compared to the length. So that's what gives them maneuverability and the capability of taking off at a low speed. But there's actually engineers studying these birds, not so much to build better airplanes, because, you know, with airplanes you got lots of time to take off and get your lift, but to build better helicopters. So, and that, by the way, I'm going to talk about this next week, but I came with a bunch of research papers basically making a point that when we look at certain animals in nature, we see that they're engineered better than our best machines. So I got half a dozen examples, but I don't want to take time in the class. I want to make sure we make some progress here in the text. Yes?
Have they mathematically done the calculation that it would be equal to do what it does when it comes down? Or is that beyond our mathematics at this point?
Okay. That's the point I wanted to make, is as much as we know about the eagle, and we know a whole lot more about eagles than at the time that this text was written, there's still mysteries about the eagle we don't understand. And of course, one of the biggest mysteries is, you know, how can we explain the features that the eagle possesses from some naturalistic process?
Mathematical calculations must be immense.
Well, what's mentioned here, and by the way, we see this in all three examples, it's mentioning animals and their behavior that can't be explained unless God supernaturally intervened and created those designs. So we see here in chapter 30 are examples in nature that basically testify of God's handiwork and tell us that, hey, the Darwinian paradigm can't explain everything that it needs to explain. Well, we talked about the snake last week. I'm not going to go into the details. We also talked about the ship on the high seas. Now, what I wanted to focus on today, and I'm really going to be counting on your help, is where it talks about the human one. The ways of a man with a maiden. And here it's talking about human exceptionalism. And also, I would argue, something we can't understand. But, for example, it's referring here to courtship. And we see courtship outside of the human species. There are birds that engage in courtship. There are mammals that engage. By the way, it's limited to birds and mammals. You don't see it in other species. So it's just the Nephis species where we see these courtship rituals taking place. But what is interesting in the scientific literature on the courtship practices and rituals amongst these birds and mammals, the more elaborate and long-lasting the courtship ritual, the higher the probability that the couple that get together will have a lifelong bond. So monogamy seems to be correlated with the length and the degree of expenditure of resources, if you like, in the courtship process. Now, I think what this is hinting at is, does that correlation apply to human beings? Now, I don't know of any research study that's been done on this. I typically don't read that kind of scientific literature. but I thought some of you might know. But it seems reasonable to me that we would find a similar correlation with human beings, because we are having a monogamy crisis today, and maybe a good part of that monogamy crisis is that our courtship rituals, our courtship practices, aren't as long-lasting or require as much investment as what they did, say, 100 or 200 years ago. And maybe there's a lesson we can learn from the animals. It was Job that said, look to the birds, look to the beasts of the field, they'll instruct you. This may be one example where we can gain some instruction. Maybe one way we can build more secure marriages is to actually invoke soul. And by the way, I think I've told you this before, I am on the autistic spectrum, so courtship for me was a real challenge. And by the way, most people I know who are on the spectrum don't get married, or if they do get married, they have a relatively quick divorce. It didn't happen in my case, mainly thanks to my wife, Kathy. But for example, people who have Asperger's syndrome or on the autistic spectrum, we can't recognize courtship rituals. So, for example, I could never recognize when a girl was interested in me. I would never know. And by the way, I was just totally clued out in expressing an interest I had in a girl. They never knew. In fact, every time I tried to express interest in a girl, nothing ever happened. And I would get so frustrated, I'd wind up writing a note or a letter, and that usually backfired. So, with one exception, with Kathy. I wrote her a letter, and she wrote me a letter back. So, and after a few months, years actually, we were able to get together. So, but what I wanted to get from all of you is, let's put this to the test. I mean, I'd like to hear from you, okay, what is it about the way of a man with a woman? What kind of investments? Because I think what's happening in today's society is that we see a lot of news stories about the proposal. I mean, isn't it kind of weird how men are going to extreme degrees to come up with a unique proposal? Whereas in the old days, you know, you would get down on one knee and ask them, will you marry me? And now you've got to have a special circumstance. It's got to be when you're on a space flight or, I mean, or when you're in Antarctica. I don't know.
Sporting events.
So... but it seems like we're investing more time and energy in something that lasts a few seconds as opposed to the whole courtship procedure where you actually spend some time getting to know one another and preparing for a lifelong time together. And I think that's interesting too about these animals. Where you see animals not having a long lifespan, the courtship time and investment is relatively minor compared to those animals that do live a long time. Ostriches, for example, have, you know, a long lifespan and a very elaborate courtship practice. And, yeah, they mate for life. And so a male ostrich and a female ostrich will mate for life. But there seems to be a correlation. You know, we human beings, we live 80, 90 years. And it's not unusual for a man to court a woman over the course of a whole year. By the way, something that is in the scientific literature is what they refer to as estrus, and that's the time when the female is actually able to reproduce, and how the courtship rituals are actually designed in such a way so that the courtship is timed in terms of its longevity and when it happens in the calendar year to match the very brief time in which the female is reproductive. With we human beings, the females are reproductive over a very long period of time. So in that context, we can afford a long time period for courtship time and investment because we're not limited biologically like these other creatures are. And you say, why are these other creatures so limited? Well, unlike us human beings, it matters when they give birth. If they give birth at the wrong time of the year, their offspring will not survive. Whereas with us human beings, it really doesn't matter much whether your child is born in December or October or July or May. The chance of survivability is quite high. Why is it quite high? Because of how much the mother and the father invest in the care of the child. That's something else you do see in the literature, is that the greater the amount of effort that's required for parental care, the more elaborate and time-consuming the courtship process. Because basically what the female is doing is say, okay, I wonder if this male is actually going to be ready to invest what it's going to take to care for the young that we're going to have. And that's a lot of what's going on in the courtship thing. And by the way, there's a big debate in the scientific literature on this, launched by no other than Richard Dawkins. And Richard Dawkins is making the point that courtship that we see in humans, as well as all other higher animals, is all based on what he calls the selfish gene. That basically we're all motivated to make sure we get really good genes being passed on to our offspring. And so the courtship is all about, okay, where can I find a mate that's got the best genes so that I can have really great children? Now, I'm not going to ask you questions. Is that really on your mind when you're courting about these genes you're going to be passing on to your children? And the other side of the debate is it's got nothing to do with people, quote, trying to figure out what genes are going to be passing on to the next generation. It has more to do with finding a mate that's going to provide sufficient investment in me and my offspring. And what are they going to be there for the long haul? And so I think that's got some application for us human beings as well. You know, is this potential partner really going to be committed to me? Are they going to care for me and love me, and not only me, but also our children? So that's a debate that's going on in the scientific community with respect to the animals. What motivates them in their courtship? Is it selfish genes, or is it something of a more social nature? And I would argue that's got implications for us human beings as well.
I think you're much further along than Richard Dawkins.
Yeah, it could be both. Well, I mean, again, what I'd like to hear from members of the class are some of your courtship experiences, because there's people who actually have a courting time that lasts maybe a week. I've known people who have met one another, it was love at first sight, a week later they were married, okay? And by the way, their marriages last. So it's not like they fall apart. Somehow the courtship all works together. Of course, we also know those stories where they fall in love immediately, they're married a few weeks later, and 2 weeks later their marriage has fallen apart. So we got stories like that as well. But usually with us human beings, it takes longer than a week. Okay. Volunteers?
Well, I suspect that it makes it a key difference if you have two people who are assuming that the essence of your being is spiritual, mental, and personality, all immaterial things. And that was common in prior generations, and it's less common today.
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess that's it.
Well, you're making a good point, is that with humans it's more complex because we are more complex. So in terms of a man and a woman coming together, there's not just the physical features that the animals are concerned about. You know, how well we're going to get together intellectually, emotionally, and spiritually. So looking for that kind of compatibility at those levels. So, and you know, which one has a greater priority and which one is more difficult to establish within a relationship. I mean, you're onto something here. The spiritual aspect is going to take a lot more time than figuring out the others. I mean, I kind of see that in society today. You know, young people are worried, are we going to be physically compatible? Hey, wait a minute. You put a man and a woman on a desert island, you don't have to worry about the physical compatibility. It's there. It's the other features that are much more challenging to evaluate, and that's what takes time. There was a... Yeah, Ted.
Well, you mentioned the selfish gene. I think the Nazis tried that out with breeding programs. And sadly, certain Americans did that with the slaves. You know, they would choose persons to be with. And as far as getting the type of a human being physically you wanted, that came out, but it wasn't so good for the families and the people that were involved in the experiment with the humans trying to play God. You know, that didn't really work out real well.
It doesn't, and on a more subtle level, it often works. And by the way, with human courtship, a complicating factor, it's not just the man and the woman. There's the man's family and the woman's family. then there's the extended family. I mean, maybe their work associates get involved as well. And so it's not just one man and one woman like you would get an animal species. There's actually a whole community that's involved. And sometimes that community can act not in an extreme fashion like the Nazis, but they're basically saying, okay, what features do we want for the wife of our son? And so there again, maybe some of the selfish gene part comes in. But I remember seeing this wonderful cartoon years ago, and it shows this really brilliant guy proposing to this really beautiful woman with the idea they're going to have children that are great looking and really smart. But of course, you know what happens, the children they have are really dumb and they're really ugly. Yeah, go ahead.
Kind of ask the question, since you get more into the language and syntax, what are they talking about, a man and a maiden, back in the context of that time? And when we talk about the courting roles, that's very different from the way things are now. So trying to see what was being said at that time, I think, is the starting point for this discussion.
Well, what's clear in this text is referring to a man that's not been with a woman and a woman that's not been with a man. So it's talking about two virgins. And it's talking about the way the man woos the virgin. So that's basically what's going on here. And the context would be, look at the Song of Solomon, which basically kind of goes into much more detail. And if you read the Song of Solomon, you can see the investment that the man and the woman are putting into their courtship. I mean, so again, compared to modern day, evidently back at the time this was written, the courtship investment was much greater than what we typically see today. And typically, it wasn't just the man, the woman. The families got involved, not just the immediate family, but the extended family. So courtship was a big deal. And also in those days, you didn't violate the courtship norms of your society. Whereas today, people feel quite free to break those norms. So. And by the way, it's becoming a worldwide phenomenon where basically these social structures that have been set up for thousands of years are going by the wayside. Yes?
You know, I was just thinking as I was reflecting on this question myself, and, you know, in the old days, how things were done in difficult times, and I feel that people do have more due diligence buying a car than they do selecting a date. And I think also, you know, of course, things that happen fast, people are attracted to something on the surface, but then when you dig deep and you look at character, integrity, like for me, I look at, you know, I own my own home and things like that. Do I want somebody who's filed bankruptcy 20 times, owes the IRS $100,000? I mean, these are things that people wouldn't think about before, and do I want to merge my life and incur that person's liability? I mean, I would go die for a person, but there's a lot of risk. So it's kind of like it's really hard. But I also think with the advancement of technology, people want things fast. It's like, okay, I think you have dinner, you know, let's go. And I'm like, wait a minute, you know, I want at least a year to see a person is throughout the whole. How do they? Are they really depressed on Valentine's and really happy on 4th of July? Or, you know, it's just really complicated because I mean, I'm very giving, but at the same time, I want to do my due diligence and I want somebody who's willing to do that with me and look at my character. But I don't think those values exist out there, so I don't want to compromise if I don't have somebody who has that same thought process. You know, it's kind of like it just seems like it doesn't exist anymore.
Sure. You know, and even a good car might only last 15 years. So I think you're wise. You want to spend more time checking out a potential marriage partner than you do selecting an automobile for purchase. Right. But it's such today, for example, that I ran into this one gal. She says, I don't date anybody until I do a background check on him. So she actually hires a detective to get a background check done. So... Well, again, if you don't have families to do that for you, I mean, that was kind of the whole idea of, you know, the two families getting together, is that they were basically doing a background check. But in today's society, that's hard to do because the family structure isn't what it used to be. So, now, yeah, go ahead.
What happens, you marry for 20 years, you get divorced, you're living the good bachelor life, seeing many women, and so all of a sudden, you see this one, and you've known her for only 3 weeks, where others you've known for years, and you hear a voice that says, marry her. And my answer was, I don't want to get married.
Well,
I'm having too much fun.
Whenever you hear that voice, where is it coming from? And also, I think, you know, gee, when I was single, I actually taught a class on this, believe it or not. So, a lot of the people in my class never got married, so. In hindsight, I should have never done that. But my whole point is, this book actually has a lot to say about courtship. And so even if you know nothing or you're on the Asperger's autistic spectrum, you still got this. This book has got a lot to say. And it's not just the Song of Solomon. I mean, all throughout the text, especially here in the book of Proverbs, it talks about, well, what should govern the way of a man with a woman? My time is up. What I want you to do when we come back, let's see, we're not going to be here for Easter. And the week after that, I'm preaching in the two services. So when we come back after that, I want some of you to be prepared with some anecdotes of what it was like during your courtship. And, you know, because we live in a very complex time today. And by the way, I got caught flat-footed trying to court Kathy because I wasn't aware of how different the American culture was from the Canadian culture. I actually terrified her parents when I asked them over for dinner. And we'd only been dating for a couple of weeks. And I said, well, you know, in Canada, the practice is you always... And I didn't have Kathy there. It was just the parents. So, and they thought it was something much more serious. And I said, no. I had to explain to them a Canadian custom that, you know, when a guy is dating a gal, the first thing he does is he checks it out with the parents. And, you know, make sure that they're even willing for this to have a beginning. But apparently here in America, it means something quite different. So, and that's why I'm asking for your help. You know, I'm not the best person to teach on this particular text, but I think a good way to start is get some anecdotes, and then we can kind of apply those anecdotes to what this book has got to say. And what you see particularly in the Jewish culture that existed. By the way, Paul talks about this. So even if you're single, notice how much Paul talked about dating and courtship. So just because you're single doesn't mean you're not able to enter into this discussion. And so I'm also prepared to hear some anecdotal stories about things that didn't go quite as this book would say. And how do we help the emerging generation? Because I think the emerging generation is facing challenges that those that are older have never faced before. And it's going to take, you know, what we see here in this text. But as we move on to the other two examples, also look at what is the text saying that's exceptional about us human beings, and what is it saying about how we should explore the mystery? And by the way, my goal here in the class is not to solve the mystery of human courtship, because this text is saying we can't solve it. But it is a challenge that God wants us to understand. So with that, let me just bow in prayer. Father in heaven, we do thank you for your servant who wrote this amazing chapter in the book of Proverbs. And Lord, I pray that it would cause us to think about things that are too amazing to understand. Not that we would give up, but we would see this as a challenge where we can get insight from your book and from your Holy Spirit, that we'd actually understand this to a greater degree than we do now, but realize that because you set this up, it is going to be beyond everything we can possibly understand. And this is a testimony that you're at work in this creation and at work in the lives of each one of us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.